morning I'd like to bring a lesson in Sunday school on the subject of the alleged evolution of man. What are the facts? And some of you have taken the evolution refutation class in Bible college, so this will be somewhat of a review for some of you, although I'm going to have some new information here as well. Others of you may not have taken the class. I think that something like this isn't as edifying, having to deal with what the devil has been teaching, but by the same token, we need to be not ignorant of his devices. We need to be free in our minds from the things that we're being barraged with constantly in the mass media. And so, for the benefit of the congregation in general, I felt it wise to talk about some of these things, especially in the area of the evolution of man, since that's the focal point of much of the evolutionist effort. You see, evolutionists have devoted more attention to trying to establish evidence for the evolution of man than for any other creature. And why is that? Simply because the whole purpose of evolution is to show that man is not a creation of, and therefore not responsible to, an omniscient and omnipotent God. And so the focal point is man. You see, the whole philosophy behind this evolutionary brainwash is to try to explain creation without a creator, to try to put man in a position of not being responsible to God. And so the focal point is going to be on man. It's not going to be on plants or animals. It's going to be upon man. And that's where most of the attention has been, most of the effort has been exercised. Especially since Darwin's time, there's been an almost fanatical zeal among evolutionists to find the missing link between man and the lower animals. You've heard this term missing link many times. And the reason is that the link is still missing. Actually, you need a lot more than one missing link. You would need a semi-infinite number of transition stages between apes and men to ever prove your point. But most of them seem to be excited if they can find even one that they could allege to be such. Now, the authorities vary widely on the subject of human evolution. Some say that men evolved from apes. Others say that both men and apes evolved from some earlier form. Some say that we evolved from ground apes. Some say we evolved from tree apes. One man even advanced the hypothesis that the reason that we have such warlike tendencies is that we evolved from killer apes. Now, in this lesson, I'm going to briefly look at the fossils claim to support the idea of human evolution and to see how strong the case really is. And I'm going to be going somewhat sequentially in the order in which these creatures supposedly evolved. So we'll be first looking at those creatures that are more ape-like and then on up the line to those alleged to be more man-like. The first candidate in our ancestry here is Ramapithecus, R-A-M-A-P-I-T-H-E-C-U-S. Now, Ramapithecus was one of the earliest stages, supposedly, in the evolution of the ape to man, according to evolutionists. And fossil evidence consists of a handful of teeth and jaw fragments. That's the total sum of the fossil evidence for Ramapithecus. Now, evolutionists claim that Ramapithecus was in man's lineage because of the teeth that were found. The incisors and canine teeth, in other words, the front teeth, are relatively small in relationship to the cheek teeth, the molars. And this is the way it is in man, whereas a lot of animals have big, large incisors and canine teeth. Now, the jaw also was in a parabolic shape, more like this with sloping sides, rather than a U-shape like an ape's jaw with parallel sides and a U-shape toward the front of the teeth. And so this is supposed to be more like men than an ape's. And there are a few other more subtle anatomical features of the jaw that are claimed to support the idea that it was more man-like than ape-like. Now, they also claim that the face was foreshortened. Now, an ape's face comes out further than a human's does. And they claim that the face on these on this Ramapithecus was shortened, although there's absolutely no face bones or skull bones found, so it seems a little bit hard to draw a conclusion like that. Now, recent research by Dr. Robert Eckhart, who's a paleoanthropologist at Penn State University, raises serious problems with the whole idea of Ramapithecus being an ancestor of man. He demonstrated that there is a great degree of genetic variation in the tooth and jaw structures, both in these fossil apes that were found and in living chimpanzees. In other words, running tests on the dental characteristics and the jaw shape and so forth of these fossils and of living chimpanzees, they found a tremendous range of variation, which makes drawing conclusions of ancestry based on tooth and jaw structures highly unreliable, because the range of variation is already greater than the so-called features that they're claiming to be manlike. Not only that, but there is a living baboon, Theropithecus galata, in Ethiopia, that possesses the same features claimed to show Ramapithecus to be manlike. It has incisors and canines small relative to the molars, has a short, deep face, closely packed and heavily worn cheek teeth, powerful masticatory muscles. All of these things would be indicators of manlikeness. Yet, this creature is alive today. It's obviously not in the lineage, evolutionary ancestry of man. So much for Ramapithecus. Again, the fossil evidence is fragmentary, handful of teeth and bone fragments, jaw fragments, and the conclusions are not warranted at all when you consider the genetic variability among apes. Now, the next one, the one that perhaps has gotten the most attention of late here, is Australopithecus. Australopithecus. Australo means southern, pithecus means ape. So southern ape is what the name means. And Australopithecus is a kind of a general term for several different fossil finds that we'll discuss here. These creatures are supposed to have lived over 1,750,000 years ago, so almost 2 million years ago. And that date is based on potassium-argon dating, which is a radiometric dating method. Normally, you can't date fossils with radiometric dating methods, radioactive dating methods, because the fossil itself doesn't contain any radioactive material. But they found these fossil bones in lava flows, which could be dated with the potassium-argon method. Now, I don't have time to go into radioactive dating methods here. Maybe I'll do that another time. But let me just give you a hint as to how reliable this method is. In 1968, they thought that they would test this potassium-argon method by checking it against known lava flows that they knew how old they were historically. In Hawaii, there was a lava flow that occurred in 1800 and 1801. And so they decided in 1968 to do a potassium-argon test on it to see what kind of result they would get. And, of course, they should have gotten an age of almost zero as far on a scale like that. It would be only 168 years old at the time they dated it. They got dates ranging as high as 3 billion years with potassium-argon for something that was only 100 and so years old, 168 years old. So that gives you a little hint as to the reliability. Now, included in this group of Australopithecus are Professor Dart's find called Australopithecus. That occurred back in 1925. And Dr. Louis Leakey's Zinjanthropus, which was found in 1959 in the Olduvai Gorge in Tanganyika, East Africa. And that is perhaps one of the most widely known because National Geographic magazine, of course, has done a running commentary on Leakey's and has supported his work there in Africa for a number of years. Now, these fossils are apes in size and form of skull and in every other respect. There's no question that they are apes. They're not men. Leakey first claimed Zinjanthropus to be a man or an ape man because of some chipped stones that he found nearby, and he assumed them to be tools. So it was not on the basis of the physical structure of Australopithecus. It indicated nothing but an ape. But because Leakey found some stones that had chips on one side, he assumed that they were tools, and he assumed that this creature had made them. And therefore, he concluded that they were evolving toward manhood, developing intelligence and so forth on the basis of those tools. So the reasoning was that if these creatures made these tools, then they were men and not apes. But Leakey himself changed his mind later and said that Zinjanthropus was nothing but an ape when he found reason to believe that the stones were made by some other creature called Homo habilis. And so he claimed that Homo habilis made the stones and probably used them on Zinjanthropus to kill them and eat them. But alas, Homo habilis is now put into the same category as Australopithecus by the authorities, and so they're not making much distinction there. Now, there is no evidence that any of these creatures use these tools, if in fact they are tools. Let me just read to you a quotation from a book. This is called Early Man. It's a book put out by the Life Nature Library. It's totally pro-evolution. In fact, this was a book that was used as a textbook for Anthropology 101 class at the University of Washington, at least a few years ago. One of the students gave it to me. And I'd like to read concerning these stone implements that were claimed to be tools. Now, this is coming from an evolutionary source. One of the most striking things Leakey noticed in the lowest deposits was a number of very primitive stone tools. To an untrained eye, it might have appeared that they were natural stones, since they bore only the faintest resemblance to tools. They were hopelessly crude. Some of them were large pebbles, others were fist-sized chunks, but all had a few chips struck from one end to make them jagged. Leakey, however, recognized that these tools had been chipped by some directing, if dim, intellect, and that the fractures were not the result of natural accident. Now, that's quite an amazing statement. There's no good pictures of this. There's a few sketches, but if you could see what these tools are, supposed tools, it's just a big hunk of rock with a few chips off of one end. You could go into any parking lot or gravel pit, any place in the country or beach or any place else and find much better tools than this. Really. I mean, I'm not just being facetious, honestly. And the thing that's quite amazing to me is they admit that they were hopelessly crude and that to an untrained eye they would appear to be natural stones. But if you've got a trained eye, you see, trained to think evolutionary, then they suddenly appear to be something designed. And here, I think one of the most remarkable things about this whole statement is that evolutionists, in general, claim that the complexity and intricacy and the order in all of living forms that we see is the result of blind chance. And yet they cannot believe that a rock that's got a few chips off of one end is the result of blind chance. It's quite a remarkable reversal of the normal way of thinking. But you see, your way of thinking changes depending on whether the evidence favors your position or not. Now, as usual, as far as Australopithecus is concerned, in general, the fossil fragment evidence is fragmentary. They have found no complete skeletons of Australopithecus. Again, it's always in bone fragments. And then there's a lot of guesswork as far as even piecing the fragments together or even knowing whether the fragments belong to the same creature. We'll get into some of that later. And there's so much contradiction and disagreement among authorities concerning this. Right now, there's a real hotly debated thing going on between Leakey and Johansson, who I'm going to talk about in a little bit, who discovered Lucy, over just exactly how these things fit in. But there's so much controversy, it's obvious that the evidence is lacking. When you have such a wide range of opinion, the reason for that is that there's very, very little data upon which to form any conclusions. And nevertheless, this massive contradictions and confusions is offered to us as proof that man has evolved. In fact, let me read a statement, an introductory statement from this book, Early Man, again, on this chapter called Becoming Man. It says, "It is now a proven scientific fact that man was millions of years in the making." Proven scientific fact. So we're not to doubt this now. "The path of his evolution is marked by dead ends and new beginnings, the wayside strewn with relics of his various forms. Though many of these remains are at best minimal, they are enough to sketch out the key stages of his march through time. The chief problem facing anthropologists today is to fill in the gaps." Now, you start off saying it's a proven scientific fact, and then you end up saying that the chief problem is to fill in all the gaps. That's quite a remarkable statement again. In other words, the data is missing, but it's a proven scientific fact. And I mean the data is really missing, even the stages that they really are claiming we're going to describe here. Now, that brings us to a discussion of Lucy. Now, Lucy is a supposed ancestor to modern man, and a lot of publicity has been generated about this more recently. This fossil find called Lucy was also grouped in the Australopithecine category, so it's also categorized as Australopithecus, just like the Zinjanthropus and so forth that we just discussed. Now, bone fragments, again, were found by Donald Johansson in 1975 in Ethiopia. And the spine is now called Australopithecus afarensis. Now, this was very similar in skull to modern chimpanzees. The skull form and the fragments of the skull were very similar to a modern chimpanzee's skull. And Johansson admits himself that a modern chimpanzee would be classified as Australopithecus if Leakey's criterion was used. In other words, if he's using the criterion of his opponent, Leakey, he'd say this is nothing other than a chimpanzee, or a chimpanzee would be an Australopithecus. Now, the reason that Lucy is connected with man at all, then, is because that Johansson believes she walked upright. And that's what the whole issue is about. As far as the skull shape and all the rest, it'd be classified as nothing other than a chimpanzee. But because of the claim that it walked upright, based on the portion of the pelvic structure that was found, the whole controversy has been generated, and the idea that this was one of the ancestors to man was promulgated. Now, before we get into the details of the question as to whether or not Lucy walked upright, it should be noted that there is a living chimpanzee called Pan Paniscus, a rare rainforest chimpanzee, that does spend much of its time walking upright. Not all of its time, but much of its time. And so its pelvic structure could be expected to reflect that. And it's possible that Lucy may be an ancestor or of the very same kind as this. But other experts do not believe that Lucy walked upright at all. Other evolutionary experts, I might add. Charles Oxnard, professor of anatomy at the University of Southern California, and Sally Zuckerman, who's from England, both question the idea that Australopithecus walked upright any more than a modern orangutan does. And I want to read a quotation here from this book, Creation, the Facts of Life, by Gary Parker. It's available on a book counter. And he says the following concerning Oxnard and Zuckerman's view on this. He says, but did the Australopithecines indeed walk upright? In the American Biology Teacher, May 1979, Charles Oxnard says, quote, now remember, this fellow's an evolutionist. In one sense, you may think there is no problem, for most anthropologists are agreed that the gracile Australopithecines are on the main human lineage. This is the view that is presented in almost all textbooks. I expect that it has been your teaching in the classroom, and it is widely broadcast in such publications as the Time Life series, which I just read from, and the beautiful television story of The Ascent of Man. Apparently they did a television special a few years back and had makeup and so forth, made people up like Australopithecus and Homo erectus and Neanderthal and the whole thing to demonstrate this. However, anatomical features in some of these fossils provide a warning against a too ready acceptance of this story. As a part of his warning, Oxnard reminds his readers of the gross errors once made in the cases of Piltdown Man and Nebraska Man. We'll talk about them in a little bit. Oxnard then proceeds to examine the evidence, and he's well qualified to do so as professor of anatomy at the University of Southern California. He points out first that the anatomical relationships can't be simply established by subjective opinion. Viewed one way, for example, the pelvic bones of Australopithecines seem to be intermediate between man and ape. But merely viewing the bones from a different angle makes the specimen seem as far distant from man as from the apes. I saw a demonstration of this. Dr. Gish had a debate, and he had some photographs that I haven't seen published anywhere else yet. I hope they will be soon. But he had some photographs of the pelvic bones of the Australopithecus, and in one shot, the shot that the evolutionists always show in their textbooks, it does look like it's somewhat in between apes and man's pelvic bones. But you just turn around and look at it from a different side, and it looks completely different. In other words, it's just the view that you're getting and certain features that appear from that view that they're drawing all of their comparisons from, not from the entire structure itself. So he says, yet another view, says Oxnard, might suggest that the fossil arose from the African apes via modern humans. In other words, that man was the missing link between the Australopithecines and the apes. So we might be the missing link. Now, Oxnard then goes on to describe in fascinating detail a computer technique called multivariate analysis. He goes into both its practical and theoretical applications and reaches two conclusions. So, in other words, they did a computer analysis on the shape of the pelvic bones and tried to get correlations that way. And their results were, first, if the Australopithecines walked upright, it was not in the human manner. If their posture resembled that of any living creature, it was most likely the orangutan. Lord Zuckerman and his research team in Britain reached a similar conclusion, stating that if we exclude creation, then one must believe that man evolved from some ape-like ancestor very rapidly without leaving a single trace in the fossil record, mainly because none of these fossils qualify. If we don't exclude creation, then we can simply accept the evidence that man has always been man, that man was the result of special creation. I say amen to that. Now, why, incidentally, should we pay attention to the opinions of Oxnard and Zuckerman rather than those of Johansson and the Leakeys? Two reasons. First, Johansson and the Leakeys are involved in more in finding specimens than in the subtleties of anatomical interpretation. In other words, they're experts in finding things, not in analyzing. Second, I think everyone can agree we are more likely to get an objective opinion from someone who is not so personally involved with the discovery itself. And this has shown out to be true for, you know, years and years and years in science. How likely would you be, after rummaging around in the sun for 35 years, to conclude that you have found the ancestor of the pygmy chimpanzee? So that's a real good point. It's a real good point. It's interesting that Oxnard and Zuckerman, though they're evolutionists, when this point is brought up in debates that I've heard between creationists and evolutionists, and how that these experts deny that Australopithecus walked upright, the reply that I've heard is, well, we don't consider them scientists, you know. They just kind of poo-poo the whole thing and discredit the individuals, the old ad hominem attack, attacking the person, when these men have just as much a credential from a scientific standpoint as any of the others. It's just that their opinion differs, and therefore they're ostracized. This kind of thing happens all the time. Now, the next candidate in the evolution of man is Homo erectus. Homo erectus, formerly known as Pithecanthropus erectus. And this fellow supposedly lived about 500,000 years ago, about 500,000 years ago. Now, the first find was by a fellow named Eugene Du Bois, a Dutch army physician in 1890. I've talked to Jack about this several times, and he's sure that he thinks that there's no relationship here. So he's not positive, but he thinks not. This occurred in 1890, and Du Bois had told his friends before he left for Java that he was going to bring back with him the missing link. So he had real confidence that he was going to go and find himself a missing link. And sure enough, he did. While digging in a riverbank in Java, he discovered a molar tooth. 1 month later, about 3 feet from where he found the molar tooth, he found the top part of a skull. Now, I should add here that the top part of a skull, the skull cap, is not sufficient to conclude even the volume of the brain. It's just not enough information there. 1 year later, he found a femur bone, a thigh bone, the upper leg bone, about 50 feet from where he'd found the skull cap. So 50 feet away, and a year later, he found a femur bone. The following month, he found another molar tooth. So we have two molar teeth, a skull cap, and a femur bone, and the femur bone is found 50 feet from where he found the others. He reasoned that these all belong to the same creature, the missing link. Now, 3 years later, in 1895, this took place over several years now, he brought the bones to Europe and presented them before the Third International Congress of Zoology at Leiden, Germany. And there the scientists were generally quite skeptical of his results, and they differed widely as to what the bones represented. Most considered it to be some sort of ape rather than an ape man. And Du Bois was apparently a little bit upset about that. He removed the fossils, had them locked up, allowing no one to see them for 30 years. And during this 30-year period of time, he changed his mind himself about them and said that they were just the bones of a giant gibbon, which is a type of ape. But also, ironically, during the same 30-year period, the men of science also changed their opinion. Now, they hadn't had a chance to look at the bone for 30 years, but they concluded that it was an ape man after all. I suppose especially in view of the fact that nobody found any better fossils in that 30 years' time. You know, they probably figured that we'll find all kinds of evidence as men are doing more investigation. When they found that wasn't the case, they began to rely more upon those earlier finds. In 1923, when Du Bois finally released them for reexamination, the femur bone was shown to be definitely human. And the skull cap, according to one evolutionist, revealed a remarkable brain of unexpectedly human-like conformation. That's what his conclusion was. But many scientists now doubt that the femur and the skull cap belong to the same creature at all. Some believe that the teeth were from a fossil orangutan, and many conclude that the skull cap was from an ape and the femur bone was from a man. And so that's about the status of it now. A few other finds are also grouped in this category of Homo erectus, one of which we'll talk about in just a moment. But they're all of a fragmentary nature. In other words, you're all just finding, in every instance, it's bone fragments that they're finding. Fragments of leg bones, fragments of skulls, fragments of teeth, and so forth, jawbone. And there's about eight other finds that are classified in the same group now. The skull of Du Bois' find was calculated from the skull cap to have a capacity of 914 cc's. Now remember, there's not enough data to really do that. They have to make a lot of assumptions to do that. But even so, you see, modern man has a average of about 1,300 cc's of volume in the brain. But there are some pygmies today that have a brain capacity of only 900 cc's. And so that would even be less than the average of what he found for this creature. So according to that, it could have been a man from a skull cap of a pygmy or something of that nature. Now, by the way, they used to teach that the size of the brain capacity was correlated with intelligence. And there was a lot of little mumbo-jumbo that was going on and trying to support those statistics. It's one of the classic frauds in science. But as it turns out, there's no correlation between the physical size of your brain and your intelligence. So if anybody, if you're going home and measuring the cc's of your brain and so forth to figure out, it doesn't have any correlation. So the most likely conclusion about Java man or Homo erectus that Du Bois had found was that the skull cap was from an ape, the femur bone was from a man. Now, another interesting sidelight was that Du Bois had found a lot of other skulls there on that same investigation that he said nothing about for 30 years. He found fully modern skulls in the very same strata in the same formation, modern human skulls, that he'd found these others. That he said nothing about it for 30 years because he was afraid that it might jeopardize the discovery that he'd made. If they knew that there were other human modern human skulls in the same deposit, nobody's going to believe that this other one was some ape man. So again, a little bit of a note of scientific objectivity there. Now, Sinanthropus is another one I'll talk about in the class of Homo erectus, or Peking man, as the most popular term for it is. Sinanthropus, Peking man, also now called Homo erectus, as I mentioned before. The original Peking man was one molar tooth,
the first fossil find, one molar tooth. And on the basis of that one molar tooth, a whole new genus of humanity was decided upon by a man named Black back in 1922. Now, since that molar tooth was found, subsequently other fragments were found, fragments of about 30 skulls, no whole skulls, but fragments of about 30 of them, about 11 jaw fragments and about 147 teeth. And all of these fossils, except for two teeth, were lost during the Japanese invasion of China in World War II, between 1941 to 1945. And nobody knows where they are now. And this is one of the great mysteries in science, what happened to the Peking Man fossils. And there's always something coming out in the newspapers from time to time. Somebody got a lead on what happened to them and so forth. As if we could just find the Peking Man fossils, we'd solve the whole riddle of human evolution, which is nonsense anyway. They have the models, castings, descriptions, and so forth from them anyway. And although, granted, the descriptions made by evolutionary investigators may not always be reliable. Even if they're trying to be honest, people tend to see what they want to see. And this has been demonstrated in tests and analysis and so forth. Even with people that didn't have any real gigantic axe to grind, your perception is colored to a great deal by the way you're thinking. And as it turns out, from the descriptions and models of the Peking Man that were found, the cranial cavity varied from about 850 to 1300 cc, so it ranged all the way up to the average for modern men. And 40% of the skulls seem to be of children under 14 years old, which would account for the smaller volumes. The average is about 1075 cc's, which is larger than the pygmies and so forth today, even if you take the average. But I think the major features that they claim on the basis of these fossil fragments, at least the castings of them, to support the idea of evolution were a receding forehead, the forehead sloping backward, and a sort of a ridge down the middle of the skull. See, apes have a big bony plate on the top of the skull, and humans are generally flat on the top, but some human skulls have a little bit more of a line or a crest down the center, and that is alleged to be ape-like. The trouble is that there are many Eskimos and Australian Aborigines that we're living today that have these same features, and unless we're willing to say they are more like apes than we are and so forth and get into this old racist argument, we've got some real problems. The obvious situation is that the range and the variation, hereditary variation in the human skull formation is pretty wide. And to draw conclusions about ape-like ancestors based on sloping forehead and so forth is pretty dangerous. If you do that, you can go down to South Center and sit yourself down on a bench and watch people go by. I've done this sometimes, and you can pick out the Neanderthals, the Homo erectus, and so forth, you know. I mean, on the basis of these features, heavy eyebrow ridges, sloping forehead, receding chin, all of that, you see, nonsense. There's all kinds of them running around today. Okay, that brings us to Piltdown Man. Piltdown Man. He's also known as Eoanthropus Dawsoni, after a man named Dawson, who was the discoverer. And in the year 1908, a man named Charles Dawson was given a fragment of a skull cap, or a fragment of a skull, found by workmen digging in a gravel pit in Piltdown, England, hence the name Piltdown Man. Now, several years later, Dawson picked up two more pieces of skull in the same gravel pit. And then another year later, a fragment of a jawbone was found, and Dawson's friend Woodward found another skull fragment. And so Dawson and Woodward made a reconstruction of the missing link out of plaster, first assuming that all of these bones came from the same creature. And since they were all bone fragments, they had a great deal of latitude as to how they were going to arrange them. They modeled a skull out of plaster of Paris the size that they thought should be about halfway between an ape and a man. And then they fit those pieces into the skull, and they gave it a size of about 1070 cc's, which they thought should be about right. And then they pressed the skull fragments into the skull as they thought they should go. And then they fit the piece of the jawbone into the plaster chinless-shaped jaw that they thought it should have. It's interesting that another evolutionist, another man who's also an evolutionist, a man named Sir Arthur Keith, said that the skull, he took the same fragments and put them into a plaster mold, and he came out with 1,500 cc's based on the same fragments that these guys came up with 1070. In other words, he came up with more than the modern average for the skull size. They came up with considerably less from the very same fragments. Now, for 40 years' time, the Piltdown Man was considered a missing link. And it was taught in textbooks as dogmatic fact that this is evidence that man has evolved from lower animals until the year 1953, when it was made known that the Piltdown Man was a very cleverly perpetrated hoax. Several investigators, Dr. Weiner, Dr. Oakley, and Dr. Clark, did some detailed testing on the specimens. and they found the following things. The lower jaw and the canine tooth are those of a modern ape, deliberately altered to look like a fossil. File marks were seen on the teeth. All the dentine had been filed off and so forth. So they found the file marks and found the evidence of the manipulation. The jaw and the teeth were artificially stained to match the cranium, artificially stained with chemicals, because fossils have tend to have a brown color from the minerals and so forth in the ground for being in the ground for so long. And so they artificially stained these bones in order to match the cranium. The chin bone resembles that of an orangutan, and the cranium was treated also with chemicals to produce that brown color characteristic of a fossil. So the whole thing was a cleverly perpetrated hoax. Now, the sad thing is that the Piltdown Man was one of the so-called proofs of evolution used in the Scopes trial in 1925. Now, some of you are familiar with that. In 1925, there was a court trial that took place in a town in Dayton, Tennessee, where a man was accused. There was a law in the books of the state of Tennessee that they were not allowed to teach evolution in the schools. And this fellow named Scopes admitted to teaching evolution to his class, but he's not even sure whether he actually...
It was the American Civil Liberties Union, our trusted friends, who came and purposely incited him to say that he had taught evolution in order to defend him because they were trying to get rid of this law. And this was used as evidence in the Scopes trial, which would later prove to be totally fraudulent. It's interesting, as far as who perpetrated the hoax, that's been quite a controversy over the years. Many have accused Dawson of being the culprit. Others said Woodward was. Others said there was a certain Roman Catholic philosopher that was involved, and some thought that he did it. And it's interesting, there's a recent article in Science 1983 magazine, that September issue, that suggests a whole new theory that it was the author of Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, is what they're claiming, is who they're claiming was the perpetrator of the hoax. It's quite an interesting article. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence against him. He was friends of Dawson and Woodward. He took walks every day that went right by the gravel pit that, where the fossils were found. He loved, mysteries and that kind of thing. He was a practical joker. He had done a lot of, he was interested in skulls and ape men. And he had gotten fossils from other parts of the world, so they knew he had access to the types of fossils that would be required to perpetrate the hoax. He had a very a real axe to grind against the scientific establishment because he was a spiritualist. And the scientists kept poo-pooing the idea of spiritualism, and he was upset at that. And he wanted to show scientists to be fools. So there's all kinds of things there that, you know, whether he was or not, I don't know, but it's kind of interesting to try to track down the perpetrator of the whole thing. They think that he may have even tried to tip him off later on, anonymously, to try to show him that a hoax had been perpetrated by putting a cricket wicket in a fossil formation to make it look like they were playing cricket, you know. And apparently at first they thought it was an elephant tusk or something like that, and they didn't quite catch on. It's quite an interesting article here if you have a chance to read it. It must have been quite frustrating if he actually had done it and tried to tip him off and they didn't even buy that. All right. The next candidate is the Nebraska Man. Nebraska Man. Also known as Hesperopithecus Harold Cookieye. I'm being serious. After a man named Harold Cook. This was found in 1925 also, the same year as the Scopes trial. And Nebraska Man consisted of one molar tooth, on the basis of which a whole new genus of humanity again was offered, a missing link. And Nebraska Man also was offered as support. In fact, whole reconstructions of Nebraska Man were published in newspapers around the time of the Scopes trial, on the basis of one molar tooth. And it was offered in the trial and so forth as evidence, but 2 years later, in 1927, they found the rest of the skeleton from which that tooth was taken. And lo and behold, it turned out to be the skeleton of an extinct pig, not of a man at all. Now, that just shows you again what kind of conclusions can be drawn from tooth structure. The one molar tooth was thought sure to be a genus of humanity, turned out to be an extinct pig. So Nebraska Man is not too, you don't get too many smiles or pleasant reactions when you bring that up to an evolutionist anymore. Neanderthal Man is the next one. Neanderthal Man is perhaps one of the most popularly characterized fossil forms. supposedly living some 100,000 to 35,000 years ago, so this would be relatively recent. And this is the most famous of the, and publicized, as I've said, of the so-called missing links. The first fossil was found in 1856 in the Neander Valley in Germany. So the term Neanderthal, Thal is the word for valley in German. So Neanderthal means the fossil from Neander Valley. It consisted of one skull cap, again the upper portion of the skull. Then in 1886, 30 years later, two similar skulls were found in a cave near Spied, Belgium. And then in 1908, an almost complete skeleton was found at La Chapelle aux Saints in southwest France. And this almost complete skeleton is the one that has characterized most of the descriptions of Neanderthal man. Anatomist paleontologist Marcelin Boulay interpreted the remains of this La Chapelle aux Saints find, and it was his descriptions of the La Chapelle aux Saints fossils that stereotyped all the descriptions of cavemen and ape men and so forth from then on. He described it as having a sloping forehead, a bent forward neck, so that the if you looked at him from the side, his neck would form a continuous line with his back, an arched back, and his head sloped forward. Heavy eyebrow ridges, long arms, you know, dragging his knuckles on the ground, as it were. Receding chin, and hair, of course, over most of the body. Later research has shown that the Neanderthal man was by no means the savage brute that he's pictured to be, and it was originally pictured to be. Professor Paul Amos Moody of the University of Vermont said this, quote, "Early restorations seem to indicate that these people did not have a fully upright posture, but later investigations have shown this interpretation to have been incorrect, having arisen from the fact that the first specimen restored was pathological, the skeleton of an individual suffering from severe rickets," unquote. Now, what he's saying is that the La Chapelle aux Saints fossil find turned out to be the bones of a very old man with a disease called rickets, which is a bone disease that causes the arching and the curving of the bone. And the reason that they got this arch stooped over, you know, knuckle-dragging ape man was that it was really the fossils of a modern man that had a bone disease. Now, the same kind of information has come out since that time. In Time magazine in May 17, 1971, there's a little article on the Neanderthal. And they claim also that it's something, as the title is something like Upgrading Neanderthal Man. They're claiming that it was the stooped over appearance and so forth and posture was due to dietary deficiency, lack of vitamin D and so forth, which can cause the rickets, not to low evolutionary status at all. And the article says that the evidence found with Neanderthal indicates that they believed in life after death, practiced very formal burial rites in life after death. They practiced a form of social security for their aged and infirm, and had very highly advanced tools and so forth. So there's no reason to indicate that they were anything other than modern man at all, just a dietary deficiency at the most. Carlton Kuhn, another evolutionist, says in his Origins book, Origin of the Races, the following. He says, quote, "They were prime examples," referring to Neanderthals, "they were prime examples of what students of human constitutional types call mesomorphs. People built more or less like these Neanderthals may be seen today in the Abruzzi Mountains, in the Alps, and in Bavaria." Now, it's interesting that Bavaria and the Alps and so forth is where they found these fossils. It's all in Europe there and in Central Europe. And he says that the general type of body structure, mesomorphs, which means that, you know, fairly heavy bones, not super heavy bone, but not light bones, the same types of skeletal structures are found in people living in those areas today. Now, the Neanderthal brain averaged 1450 cc's, which is 150 cc's larger than the modern average. So if you're going to go by brain size again, are we devolving or evolving in reverse? And concerning the alleged sloping forehead, and that's one of the major features of Neanderthal that's pointed to all the time, is a sloping back forehead. A very interesting parallel was drawn in the book After Its Kind by Nelson. I don't have the book with me today, but he's got a picture there of a painting that was done of Marquis de Lafayette, the Revolutionary War hero, the Frenchman that was helping the Americans against the British in the Revolutionary War. And it was a profile portrait done of him, and there's no reason to believe that it's anything other than accurate as far as the shape of the forehead and so forth. If you take a Neanderthal skull with a sloping forehead and superimpose it on that picture, you can demonstrate that Lafayette was clearly a Neanderthal. And, of course, remember, this La Chapelle aux Saints find was found in France. So are we going to say that French are Neanderthal or what, you see?
Now, I've got some French background myself, so I'm going to talk to you with you. There are, in other words, Neanderthal men running around today. In fact, Dr. Gish, in his debates, often brings this point up. He says that if you would take a Neanderthal, as they reconstructed him, and give him a shave and a haircut, and put a suit on him, and set him out in any street and so forth, nobody'd ever take a second look. And he said that nowadays you can forget about the shave and the haircut. He said in some parts of San Diego you can forget about the bath, too. But here's to support this same idea, the Harvard anthropologist Ernest Houghton once said in his book Up from the Ape, and this is a classic evolutionary work, so this is an evolutionist in an evolutionary book, saying, quote, "You can with equal facility model on the Neanderthaloid skull the features of a chimpanzee or the lineaments of a philosopher," unquote. Now, what he's saying is you take a skull of a Neanderthal and you can put, depending on how you put the soft parts on it, you can make it look like a philosopher or make it look like a chimpanzee. Now, remember that fossils only show the bones. The soft parts are all deteriorated. So there isn't any way to know what the hair was like, what the skin was like, what the facial features were like. I mean, you can see a person, a skull, you have no idea what that person looked like. The same is true as far as the fossils are concerned. These reconstructions that are given in magazines and so forth are only artists' conceptions based on their evolutionary presuppositions. And if you don't have the evolutionary presuppositions, you can take these same skulls and make them look perfectly modern. So the Neanderthal was definitely a human race, no more unusual than any type that we have living here today. In fact, the Neanderthals, as far as their implements and stone and other things found with them, artifacts, indicate that they were far more civilized than a lot of tribes that are on the earth today. And of course, this whole idea of the Stone Age and the Iron Age and the Bronze Age and so forth, you can find any of these ages right now, depending on what part of the world you go to. They're not sequential ages in evolutionary history. They are simply different manifestations, more than likely, of the decay and disorder and the curse when man fell away from God and went into darkness and lost the knowledge that he had before. Now, another candidate is the Cro-Magnon man, or Cro-Magnon man, C-R-O-M-A-G-N-O-N. And he lived only about 30,000 years ago, according to evolutionists, so he's fairly recent. First found in 1868 in France by a man named Lartet, they have found five skeletons and other fragments that are modern in every sense of the word. Now, they're finding complete skeletons. I think it's quite interesting that whenever they find complete skeletons, they're just like modern man. But when they find these supposed old fossils that are transitions, it's always fragmentary, where you have to fill in the details yourself. It's kind of convenient. The five skeletons and other fragments were found that are modern in every sense of the word, tall, handsome, regular features, high forehead, larger brains than the average man today, and many more skeletons have been found since that time. Now, these are the people who made the famous cave paintings and are known popularly as cavemen. Distinguishing feature are these cave paintings that were found in the caves where these bones were found. Now, these paintings reveal a high degree of artistic ability. They're not crude scratchings on a wall by some primitive savage that, you know, can't even speak. They are manifestations of a very high degree of artistic ability. And the only difference between Cro-Magnon and modern man, even by evolutionist admissions now, is at best a cultural difference only. In other words, there's no physical difference, genetic difference, anatomical difference at all. And the cultural difference is established based on the findings of stone tools and implements with them. And their art and tools, as I said, are much more advanced than many tribes living today. So again, Cro-Magnon man offers no evidence that man has evolved. Now, even since that time, there have been some relatively recent finds by Richard Leakey, the son of Louis Leakey, who had discovered the Zinjanthropus, as I discussed earlier. And Richard Leakey, in 1972... found fossil remains near Lake Rudolph in Kenya, East Africa. And he found them in deposits dating 3 million years ago, according to potassium argon. Now, I should say here that I don't have any confidence in potassium argon dating, as I mentioned before. But just for the moment, just for the sake of argument, let's go ahead and let him have this 3 million year date, because it's going to get him in real trouble. They claim that these fossils, according to this dating, were 3 million years ago. Now, that puts them at least a million and a quarter years before Australopithecus. And Australopithecus was supposed to be one of the early stages in the evolution of an ape to man. So now we've got something that dates over 1 million years before that time, and the skull is modern. having no heavy eyebrow ridges, a very thin skull wall like the modern man, and a shape like modern man. National Geographic printed a reconstruction with a typical simian nose. Of course, they reconstruct it to make it look ape-like, if at all possible, so they put a nose that looks more like an ape. But if you put a human-like nose on the same thing, of course, they have no way of knowing what the nose was like. If you put a human-like nose on it, it would be indistinguishable from modern man. And the leg bones were exactly the same as modern man. And Richard Leakey himself admits that this find eliminates Australopithecus, Homo erectus, Neanderthal, and all the rest from the lineage of human ancestry. Because, you see, if modern man was there back 3 million years ago, before Australopithecus and all these rest of the guys came along, then they were not transition stages between apes and men. Men were already there. And now we have absolutely no transition creatures whatsoever for mankind. And so it's kind of thrown the whole picture of evolution of man into a turmoil now. If these finds are true, and of course their problem is that they're accepting potassium-argon dating, and we could probably help them out with that, but they won't want to give up those dating methods. And so if they don't want to give up the dating methods, they're really stuck, because now they've got modern man long before any of these others evolved. And of course, as I said, that's really changed the whole picture of late. Now, in closing, I want to just give some summary statements concerning the whole, all of these observations we made about human fossils. Number of problems exist. First of all, they're very small in number. The number of human fossils is very small. Fossil humans are extremely rare in the fossil record, and those that can be used to so-called prove evolution are much more rare. So in other words, of the majority of fossil humans that you find, they're normal. The only ones that cause any tension, draw any tension, are the abnormal ones, and if the normal ones are rare, the abnormal ones are even more rare. I would like to read an interesting quote on this point. This following quote is from the Moral Majority Report, August 1983, page 18. In an article by J.D. Bell called Creationists Are Victims of Conspiracy, he quotes this. It's very interesting. Walter Cronkite, in a recent Universe program on TV, apparently a television series, mentioned that all the fossils of prehistoric man from all the museums in the world would not cover the top of a pool table. Now, that gives you a little bit of an idea as to how many fossils are. I've mentioned that all these are very fragmentary. He says if you take them all out of all the museums all over the world, put all the fossils of all these pre-human forms and lay them out, they wouldn't cover the top of a pool table. Now, so they're very small in numbers. Secondly, they're fragmentary in nature. Very few completed skulls and even fewer complete skeletons have been found, as we've seen. A fellow named Dobzhansky, another evolutionist, says that it goes without saying that virtually all fossil finds are fragmentary, and that investigators often submit to the temptation of speculating on the basis of scanty bone fragments. So at least some of them are recognizing this, that it's too easy to speculate. Houghton says that most skulls are fragmentary, the faces are usually missing. Even reconstructing facial skeletons leaves room for a great deal of doubt as to details. The facial bones are very thin, and so they're normally broken off, and the skull you only find the upper portion in the jawbone. And so they don't even know how to put the bones into the face properly, necessarily. And then, after you have the bones in the face, then the soft parts, of course, will be up to their imagination. He says that to attempt to reconstruct soft parts is even more hazardous. The lips, eyes, ears, nose leave no clues on the underlying bony parts. On a Neanderthaloid skull, you can model the features of a chimpanzee or those of a philosopher. I quoted this earlier. Now, here's an interesting statement. He says that the alleged restorations of ancient types of man have very little, if any, scientific value and are likely only to mislead the public. That comes from this book, Up from the Ape, page 329, and it's an evolutionary source. But he's, and that's exactly what they've done, and that's what exactly what they're designed to do. This book has a whole chart, one that probably most of you have seen somewhere or another, this whole chart of the evolution of man, going back here from Australopithecus and so forth on up, through the ones that we described, and they give you the reconstructions, and of course they put the hair on according to where they think they are in evolutionary status. The lower down they are, the more hair they have, you see, and they keep losing hair and so forth eventually until they get to modern man. Now, none of that is evidenced in the fossil record. That's all pure imagination and evolutionary speculation. There's no data to support that at all. Now, another problem is the problem of scattered remains, the fact that there's no way to know if a given skull belongs to a given skeleton, or if any other bones are from the same individual. Many mistakes are made where they've gotten animal bones mixed with human bones and so forth, and they come up with missing links. There's no way to prove that these bones have been are all from one individual, especially when they're generally found scattered among other bones. Many insist that bones found by them in a scattered area belong to the same individual, but doubt that scattered fragments discovered by someone else belong from the same individual. That's the kind of thing that Du Bois had to deal with. Now, also, it's very dangerous to base classification on bone structure alone. Now, unfortunately, that's all we have to work with in the fossils in general, although once in a while certain fossils have been found where soft parts have been preserved. They found imprints of dinosaur skin, for example. They found fossils of fish and so forth with a color of the skin and so forth still intact, but that's generally pretty rare. Most of the time you're finding bones, and it's very dangerous to base classification on bone structure. For one thing, skeletal features are easily affected by environmental changes, both internal and external. By that I mean external environmental factors, injuries, diseases and so forth, hereditary factors, just the normal hereditary variation in human beings, nutritional factors. If they're not getting the right diet and so forth, that can affect the bone structure, and some of these diseases that we mentioned, acromegaly, cretinism, rickets, and so forth, can be the result of poor diet or other causes, and they can affect the skeletal structure. Another evolutionist named Simons says that high physical and dental variability in both men and apes has not long been known, but was not taken into account by the majority of past and recent describers of fossil hominoids. And that's a good point. It's something we brought up earlier when we were talking about Ramapithecus, that we know that there's a tremendous degree of variation among human beings and a tremendous degree of variation among apes as far as skeletal structure and tooth structure. And it would be very easy if we could take x-rays of everybody in the building here to arrange people in a sequence from the most ape-like to the most modern human-like, you see, and show an evolution even among people that are living here just because of the variation that exists. And if you assign certain criteria or certain associations with certain characteristics, then you can set up a sequence and try to demonstrate an evolution, but it wouldn't be true at all. All you have is variation. Then finally, there are classification problems. Usually fossils are named to make them appear to be something new. That's what happened with Java Man, that's what happened with Australopithecus and so forth, Homo habilis. A number of them were named so that they looked like they were brand new. And then later on, they were lumped into another category with all the rest. You see, each man is interested in gaining a name for himself. We have to admit this is true. This is true among scientists as well as anybody else. And history has borne this out over and over again. And they want to have the honor of discovering some new form, and the more unusual, the better, to make it look like they've really made a significant discovery. And so the tendency is going to be to overemphasize and exaggerate any unusual features in order to gain recognition. And it's also going to be to try to name it to appear to be something new. And, of course, this is not scientific conduct. It's perfectly human conduct, carnal conduct, fleshly conduct, but it's not scientific. And it needs to be taken into account when we analyze these things. So that'll give you kind of a brief overview of what the situation looks like today. Right now, at the present state, it's quite in turmoil. You've got Leakey and Johansson arguing about Australopithecus. You've got Richard Leakey's discoveries that seem to throw a question into the whole idea of the evolution of man, and still we are far, far, far from ever coming up with a missing link. But all one needs to do is to look at the scriptures, to see what the Word of God says. Now, you see, we're talking about physical features here, but there's obviously a lot more different about man and apes than physical features. The nature of the soul, completely different in human beings than it is in an ape, and then the existence of a spirit. Now, those are things that evolutionists don't acknowledge. If it's not material, they don't acknowledge it. If it's not chemicals, if it's not chemistry, they don't acknowledge it. But it's true nevertheless, and in fact, it's the only explanation for life, is that there is such thing as soul beyond the chemistry of life itself. It's good to know the truth, and it's good to be able to look into some of this information just to let you know what's really going on. What you read in the newspapers are accounts written by people who are totally committed evolutionists. They believe it. They are not critical about it. They're not really searching and examining. They're not raising the kinds of questions that need to be raised about this whole issue. And so I felt it would be good to raise some of those questions to give you a more balanced view of what's going on. God bless you. Amen.